Consumer Choice Center, David Clement, North American Affairs Manager. To the witnesses, thank you very much for accepting our invitation so that you can share with us your opinions and answer our questions for budget C-97. Mr. Clement, please.
Good morning, members of the committee. First off, thank you very much for the invitation to appear before the Senate Committee on National Finance. My name is David Clement. I am the North American Affairs Manager for the Consumer Choice Center. As a global consumer advocacy group, we represent patients and consumers who embrace increased choice, innovation, and smart regulatory policy, which is what brings me here today. For my statement, I'd specifically like to address two cannabis-related items within Bill C-97, the first being Part 1H, the amendment to the income tax to reflect current regulations for accessing cannabis for medicinal purposes. So Part 1H changes the Income Tax Act so that newly legal forms of medical cannabis, edibles, topicals, extracts, will be eligible for the medical expense tax credit. So first off, as a group that represents consumers and patients, it is positive that the government is providing some relief and moving to allow new forms of medical cannabis to exist within the tax credit system. Although that does give patients some relief, it does nothing to address the longstanding issue of taxation on medical cannabis. We, who are among many, have significant problems with the government's decision to continue to tax medical cannabis, whether that be excise or sales. These taxes unfairly punish patients for the crime of simply using the prescription medicine that was given to them or prescribed for them. And so although the expansion of what qualifies as a medical expense is appreciated, it would be much preferred if the government were to simply tax exempt medical cannabis as other prescribed medicines are. The second item I'd like to address is Part 3, which is the new excise tax rate framework for edibles, extracts, and topicals. So specifically, that is the new tax framework based on THC potency at a rate of a quarter of a cent per milligram. When you combine that with a milligram of THC, when you combine that with the provincial rates, it's a cent per milligram of THC. So the first issue with this tax framework is obviously when it's applied to medical cannabis, it directly targets medicine based on efficacy. And we have data, a recent study from the Journal of Palliative Medicine, that shows when examining medical cannabis usage patterns for cancer patients, they actually prefer their medicine to be high in THC, opting for potency over quantity. For medical patients, these new changes will ultimately mean that their more desired medical products of higher THC will be taxed at a higher rate than lower THC products, thus actually discouraging them or encouraging them to do the exact opposite of what they would otherwise prefer to do. The second issue with the changes in terms of tax rates and this framework, so the limit for edibles is 10 milligrams per package. That leaves the excise tax on those products to be relatively small. So 10 milligrams would be 10 cents. However, when we look at the products of topicals and extracts, the way the framework is set up could lead to steep additional costs for consumers. So if we take a topical or extract, the maximum THC in the intermediate container is 1,000 milligrams of THC. At the higher threshold, that would mean that a, let's say, $40 1,000 milligram THC topical product would carry a $10 excise tax attached to it, along with a sales tax. If we take that example of a $40 product, that means that once you combine those taxes, taxes would inflate the shelf price by close to 40%. And this matters, the cost prohibitive nature of it matters, because we as Canadians want the legal market to thrive for the purpose of stamping out the black market. Our concern is when you have excessive taxation, like I just mentioned, on these new topicals and extracts, it will make it highly unlikely that these products will be purchased legally and could actually serve to be counterproductive in the sense that it would give rise to more attractive, unregulated black market products, thus keeping consumers in the black market. And so in closing, I think the question that we need to ask on these excise tax rates, specifically for medical cannabis, is does our federal government want to make regulated medicinal cannabis more or less affordable for the patients who need it? If the goal is ultimately to make medicine more affordable, then taxing medicine cannot be the answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Donc, the chair will recognize for question first Senator Marshall, to be followed by the Senator Pratt, the vice president.
Thank you very much, Mr. Senator Chair. Thank you very much for your presentations. We're talking about cannabis edibles, cannabis extract, and cannabis oil, and cannabis topicals. Cannabis edibles, are they available now? I thought that was deferred to sometime in the future.
They are not available now.
They're not available now?
Well, they are available illegally, but not legally.
I know they're, but legally is what I was referring to.
Yeah.
So what about the cannabis extracts and the cannabis oil and the cannabis topicals? Are they available now?
Oils, yes. Topicals, no, although that can be a gray area depending on how you define a cannabis product. There are certainly CBD topical products that exist. The legality of those, I think, is very gray right now. So those do exist. Those do and don't exist, and oils do exist.
Okay. So my question is relating to the availability of some of those products now, and then I guess the edibles into the future. And I'll start with you, Mr. Clement, because I know in your opening remarks you did talk about the availability of products and the black market. There's a shortage of cannabis products. We all know that because we're listening to the news. So how do we go about ensuring that supply meets demand?
So I think the best way to go about ensuring that supply meets demand is changing the production regulations so that they more represent how government bodies treat alcohol production and less like how we treat pharmaceutical production. So right now the cannabis market or cannabis producers are regulated as if they are a pharmaceutical product for the most part, very strictly. I think that those rules could be loosened to allow for more scalability. I think another suggestion that was actually pointed out by my colleague here was the streamlining of the excise tax system. I think that that could do a lot in terms of allowing for product mobility. Right now, excise tax implementation and stickers ensure that legal product is landlocked in particular provinces, so you can't shift product from one store to another across provincial boundaries to meet demand. I think that that would certainly help as well.
Okay, so there'll be no taxes collected unless there's an availability of supply. So
negative externality if we were to apply THC content to dried product, and that would be the repercussions that would have on the black market, because that would make high THC black market products more attractive than they already are, because they would be competing against products that are taxed at an increasing level. And if stamping out the black market is the goal, which I certainly think it is, we have to be mindful of policies. Although I certainly appreciate simplification, and trust me, the process of going through these tax rates and trying to figure out what is taxed at which rate and how that's applied is quite confusing. But that would be one potentially negative consequence that would send a pretty clear signal to those who are in the black market and would highly concentrate the product available in the black market at that higher THC threshold.
Mr. Clement, what is your response to the government's argument on why they do not want to exempt medical cannabis? And their argument is simply that if they do that, consumers who don't have a medical reason for getting a medical cannabis will try to get a prescription or whatever, because medical cannabis will be a lot cheaper.
I think so. Yeah, that criticism or that response has been brought up to me in the past. basically the argument was that if they exempt medical cannabis, you'll have people lining up to get their
registration.
Their registration. I think that's largely a question for the integrity of the medical community. I think that that isn't. I don't think that taxing all medical patients because of a few potential bad actors is appropriate policy. So that would be my response to those who have raised that objection. I certainly think that it's possible you could have some folks try and game the system to get a prescription for medical cannabis to avoid taxation. But then again, that also depends on how the legal market unfolds over the next year or 2 years in terms of storefront availability, catching up with supply. As the legal market matures, I'm of the opinion that the incentives for recreational consumers to go through the hassle of going to see a doctor, getting a prescription refilled, waiting in the mail when they could go into a storefront. My interpretation or belief here is that as the market matures, that will become increasingly less likely.
Yeah.
So I, from my perspective, I think it largely comes down to three issues. One is price. Taxation is a huge factor in that. Other regulations that impact production costs obviously play a role in inflating price. Accessibility is another issue. For the most part, is not the purview of the federal government. That is mostly provincial and then local governments. There are a handful of policies that are misguided at that point, at those levels of government, but that might not be as relevant to what we're doing here today. And then the third is product variability, which is really something that we haven't seen yet, which is something that we are hopeful in terms of offering consumers more choice in terms of a variety of products. Unfortunately, the framework for legalization rolled out dried cannabis and oil while giving a year to roll out other arguably less harmful means of consumption. And so our hope is that as these new harm reduction products, if we want to call them that, become available, you'll see consumers opt for the legal market because the legal market now has more options and more choice. And the more choice we can infuse into the legal market, the better, because that's ultimately what's going to make it more attractive.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Senator Klein to be followed by Senator Ravaglia.
This might play on some of the other questions asked, and anybody can jump in on this, but I'm trying to unravel the flow chart of how things could go with medical cannabis for medical purposes. And I suppose it could start with the patient, and they may go see a doctor with the intent of getting a prescription, or they may be just going to see the doctor to find out what's wrong with them. If it is with the intent to get cannabis prescribed, the doctor may deny it, which could then lead to, if it was denied, then could lead to self-medication and the black market, I suppose. If they didn't, or maybe they just want to bypass the doctor altogether and self-medicate. Again, that leads to going to the black market. Does it get complicated for someone to get cannabis for medical purposes when you start thinking about you need to get a prescription, you need to apply for a tax credit, it's probably overpriced if they know what the price is compared to black market? And I don't know how the black market handles that. Do they sell by the THC? I don't think so. Do they issue tax credits? I don't think so. So where does this all lead? Is there going to be an uptake on the cannabis for medical purposes and the tax credit? And how much will the uptake on tax credit be? Or is it going to really gravitate more to the black market because it's simpler and it's they don't need a prescription? That said, I guess there's a caution for the viewing audience that self-medication and cannabis for medical purposes has its own issues.
Yeah, so it would be, the best way to describe it would be someone with severe seasonal allergies. If you go to your doctor and you get a prescription for prescription grade insert brand of allergy medicine, that falls under a pharmaceutical, or you could just go and grab an over-the-counter And it would be a over-the-counter drug that you take that doesn't qualify for the tax credit. And so that would be the circumstance that medical cannabis patients would fall into. I think the question is if it becomes too burdensome for them to access medical cannabis through a doctor, they will most likely go to either the legal recreational market or the illegal recreational market. From our perspective, what we've seen is that consumers who were consuming what we would consider heavy amounts of cannabis prior to legalization, for the most part, are not making the transition to the legal market because of price and accessibility. And so the goal would be, or the hope would be, that medical patients don't fall into that trap, which is part of the reason why we've so strongly advocated against taxing medical cannabis in the first place, is because obviously you don't want the cruelty of punishing patients, but also you don't want to encourage them to engage in illegal activity to simply get the medicine at prices they can afford.
Thank you.
Senator Ravaglia, to be followed by Senator Dean. Senator, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will preface my question recognizing that we have little or no control over the black market. What my concerns are that the long-term sequelae of high-dose THC products continues to remain uncertain. While studies are in evolution, should we not continue to create a disincentive via taxation until we have clear scientific evidence of risk versus benefit in the higher THC products? My concerns as a recently practicing physician were in the areas of tolerance, psychosis, and in particular adolescent vulnerability, and I've seen instances of each of these. The other concern I would have is that we made this mistake with opioids. We did not, at the outset of prescribing opiates for non-malignant pain, set any margins in terms of doses, and today we're dealing with a grave public health crisis across the Western world. So I'd be interested. I mean, you know, this may partially be a philosophical question, but, you know, as a physician, I would be very, very concerned about high-grade THC products being indiscriminately used for the high factor without the long-term sequelae being taken into account.
So my only additional comments on this is that, yes, you want to be precautionary and there are associated risks and we need to know those risks. However, we have to avoid public policy that has grave externalities that push consumers into a marketplace that has no care in the world for their safety whatsoever, or their age, for instance. And so you have to balance, obviously wanting to curb or eliminate youth access entirely, while also realizing that if we are too heavy-handed in our regulatory approach, it only fuels the black market, which has no care for how old the people are who are purchasing, product quality, product safety, et cetera. And so we have to strike that balance in terms of making sure that price, access, product variability are appropriate so that consumers, when purchasing, are doing it legally, are of age, and are removing themselves from all of the negatives of prohibition, which is the reason why our country legalized in the first place.
I'm just going to go back briefly now to the incentives and disincentives around around pricing. And Mr. Clement, you reminded us, as I think did the McClellan Ware report, that price availability and variability are key factors. And if one takes a look inside an illegal store and then you go next door to the legal store, In the legal store, it's more Apple-like, I might suggest, and high-tech and clean, but with a sharply reduced range of products. And so, you know, one can wander into these places and test this. I'm going to go back to the issue of price and incentives. As we think about taxing for THC potency, and we had this discussion in the Social Affairs Committee, And McClellan and Ware made some recommendations on this too, and I agree with it. We have to bear in mind, I think, that we already have a considerable price differential, such that the long-term illegal recreational consumer buying 30 grams of dried cannabis is probably buying it at half the price if they stay with their in the current market, of the price that would be available walking into a legal cannabis store. Would it not make sense, as we think about now tacking on potency variables, to reconsider the entire price differential? So that, I mean, what we don't want to do, I think, is stack potency differentials, taxes, on top of a price differential that, although, as Ms. Jessamine suggests, is tolerated because of quality and safety, that tolerance is not going to be without its limits.
Mm-hmm.
So question is, as we think about taxing on potency, do we need to consider the entire pricing framework in order to, if you like, redistribute that premium and move it towards higher potency products?
So yeah, I think you raise a good point in terms of reevaluating the tax system. It's in its entirety. That includes the various fees and taxes that are associated with production at the federal level. I think that should also include some perspective on what provincial governments are doing in terms of their own tax rates, their own boutique tax rates that they add. So if you use Manitoba as an example, I think the benchmark is legal cannabis is taxed at a rate of 29% once you factor in all of the taxes. It's naive for us to think that the legal market can compete in that context. So I would certainly welcome this potency question to open up the door to a reevaluation of overtaxation of cannabis in general, the creation of a smarter, more consistent tax model that allows for better competition, while maybe balancing some of the harm reduction aspects that my colleague here has mentioned. That would certainly be welcome from a consumer's perspective, because the goal here is to get consumers to purchase it legally, and we have to provide them the incentives to do so. And price is a huge factor in that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Klein to be followed by Senator Forêt.
I'm trying to follow closely here to find out how this is all shaking out in terms of, since this has been legalized, there's been some missteps, there's been some delays, lessons learned on probably things around supply and demand, pricing. And with that comes a lot of frustration on both sides, supplier and customer, if you will. There's recreational use, medical use, and now this new wave of alternative cannabis products, new to me anyway. And I don't know how the, I'll call it the black market, I guess, how that is keeping up competitively with the alternative products. But are things panning out well here for the provinces monetarily? And also, there was huge policing concerns in the beginning of this, and monies and resources that were going into getting training and equipment for all this in terms of impairment. Is it unfolding the way people had somewhat forecasted, or is this thing a little bit of disarray and frustration on all fronts?
I don't think I have too much more to add other than to the question of, are the provinces making money off of this? I mean, there is anecdotal evidence from province to province that their distribution models are not turning a profit. And part of that is sales, as Mr. Armstrong mentioned. I think part of that is the framework in which they set up distribution, public versus private, mixed, et cetera. But then again, those are separate conversations outside of the purview of the federal government. So there are certainly provinces who are turning heavy losses, at least in the short term, in comparison to their forecast of how much revenue they generate.
Just a quick follow-up question, please, if I may, Chair. So I wasn't around last year through all the great debate and discussion. I understand it was quite vibrant and rigorous. was the driving factor around the objective being getting control of that market and taking it out of the hands of the illegal, balanced with revenues, I suppose? And if it's only at 15 to 20% on the legal side, are they winning the day against taking this out of the hands of the illegal and youth, for instance?
I think in the question of more products and what would be appreciated from the federal government is a more dynamic approach to how the industry is regulated more generally in terms of seeing where the issues are and responding quickly to them. Because there are plenty of people out there who are pointing out or forecasting a lot of these errors, and they happen, and the government is particularly slow at changing particular regulations or actually goes in the opposite direction. So an example of that, in my opinion, would be the new production regulations that act as a barrier for new entries into the production market. From my perspective, or from the Consumer Choice Center's perspective, all that does is discourage new entry, which discourages competition, discourages increased supply, and just topples on to some of the other complications that we've discussed already.
Thank you. Senator Forest, s'il vous plaît, to be followed by the Senator Ravalia to complete.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Merci de votre témoignage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. You've just said, Mr. Clement, that several mistakes have been made, some errors that have made it more difficult for new producers. Did I understand correctly?
Parce que on a connu particulièrement au Québec, pas l'information.
Because in Quebec, I don't know what the case was in the other provinces and territories, but at the outset, there were significant problems with the stock. And clearly, some stores didn't have a steady stock for merchandise coming in. So it's not that we want to encourage any use of cannabis, but we want to take away the people shopping in their option to shop in the black market. If there isn't any stock in the stores, they're going to turn to the illegal market. So currently, do you think... I mean, we know less about this, and I heard less about that recently, but is that same thing across the country?
It's a problem across the country. It's not just Quebec who's experiencing that problem. It's not just Quebec. In terms of those errors, if there are additional questions on what those errors federally have been, I can certainly elaborate on that. But in terms of supply and what's available on shelf space across the country, for the most part, it's a uniform problem. And there are some federal excise tax issues that actually prevent that stock issue from getting corrected prevent the market from reallocating product based on demand regionally.
In what way does the excise tax, as you say, prevent things from being rebalanced, the supply to the new market?
Cannabis market, in terms of excise tax, was set up in a similar fashion as tobacco, in terms of excise tax stickers. Once a product is delivered to the province in which it's to be sold, it gets given an excise tax sticker. And that means that product cannot be sold outside of the province. And so in a more dynamic or open market, you would have retailers, legal licensed retailers, or legal licensed wholesalers, in some sense, in many cases, provincial bodies run by the government, broker deals based on what residents in a particular region are wanting for product availability. And so you could have the Nova Scotia Liquor Control Corporation in negotiation with the OCS in Ontario to reallocate product accordingly, because let's say there's a little more demand in Toronto and Nova Scotia has overpurchased specific strains or particular products. That can't happen in the existing excise tax system, and so it landlocks product once it's arrived in a particular province. And that's a big problem because in order to respond to demand, there's the sheer volume question. We have to have the sheer volume to respond to demand, but then that product has to have the mobility to adjust to demand regionally around the country. And so Mr. Armstrong did mention that in his opening remarks, and I think that that's a tremendous suggestion in terms of reevaluating the excise tax system and ensuring that product can move between provinces.
Merci.
I have one additional point on that. From the perspective of consumers, which may or may not be at odds with the public health perspective, depending on the issue, right now, the legal framework for advertising in the cannabis space is nearly non-existent. If you were to ease that up, you could create a scenario where consumers are better informed about what their legal options are, better informed about different product varieties that are available to them, lower risk products that are available to them. So there is a means of loosening some of those quite strict rules to inform consumers, because I think that when we look at branding and advertising, and this is how the legislation was originally written, branding and advertising were solely understood under the context of promotion. But there is a strong informational factor that is at play there, and I don't think the existing legal framework complements or allows for that, or allows for industry to educate consumers in that way. So I think there could be room to obviously keep things reasonable in terms of promotion and the promotion of use, while also ensuring that consumers are being educated about availability, about price, about how the legal market is superior. If you're already a consumer of cannabis, here's why, X, Y, and Z on why you should purchase legally. I think there's a way to change current advertising laws to accommodate that goal and increase consumer information.
Add, as we go forward before we table our report in the chamber in the Senate, please do not hesitate to send your comments through the clerk of the committee. And before we close then, senators, I have a question. And we're still in uncharted waters. And in the last three weeks ago, as a matter of fact, I had the opportunity to talk to students at university, and we had business professors present. And a question that they asked, and I said, you know, I'll take the opportunity if when the time comes to ask a question to the professionals. So I see three professionals in front of me that also has, you have the experience, and you've seen where we are going with this product. So I'm asking you, would the distribution sale of cannabis work better if it was managed by the private sector?
So the answer to that question, I think, would be a resounding yes for me in terms of the private sector being able to better handle this, handle the question of distribution. The private sector, simply put, is more dynamic. It's able to change and deal with fluctuations in demand far better than government institutions are. On the question of retail, I think it's a fair point to say that consumers are generally happy with access, whether it's public or private. The difference between public retailers and private retailers is that private retailers don't pass on their losses onto taxpayers. The example being Nova Scotia, I think their loss annually is north of $20 million. It's ultimately taxpayers who are paying for that. The alternative would be a system like Alberta or where there are private stores. When those stores fail, they fail because, or when they fail, they don't pass on those losses onto taxpayers, and they have a better incentive not to fail, which means they're more consumer friendly, they're more competitive on pricing, and so that would be my answer to that question.
Thank you. To the witnesses, as we close, Thank you very much for sharing your opinions, your comments. It's been very informative and you've given us clarity. And to the Honorable Senators, tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m., we will be receiving the Minister of Finance of Canada at our meeting. So it'll be at 2 p.m. at room 257 East Block. On this, I now declare the meeting adjourned.